Tonight on Arena, we preview Halston, the new Netflix series with Ewan McGregor as the famous designer, and Lisa McInerney on her new novel, The Rules of Revelation. +51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. Halston, a new limited series available on Netflix from today and starring Ewan McGregor, tells the story of the US fashion designer Roy Halston, who shot to fame as Jackie Kennedy's milliner but went on to become one of the defining forces in 1970s fashion, dressing the glamorous women of the era, including most notably the one and only Liza with a Z Minnelli. The series Halston is produced by the prolific TV supremo Ryan Murphy, doesn't hold back when it comes to the depiction of the more salacious aspect of the designer's life, but does it hit the mark when it comes to the fashion? Well, joining me this evening to discuss just that are designer and couturier Peter O'Brien and Penny McCormick, deputy editor of The Gloss magazine, who've both been taking a look at the series. Peter, before we get into the show itself, maybe give us a sense of, first of all, who Halston was for the uninitiated and just how important he was in terms of fashion design.
I think he was incredibly important particularly in his kind of heyday in the 70s, because we'd gone from the 60s to kind of hippies and love children, and there were two kinds of clothes. There were kind of matronly grown-up clothes and there were kind of hippie young people clothes, and what he did was he made incredibly minimal, simple clothes. He took out the buttons, the bones, the bows, the belt. He just made everything very, very minimal, very simple. And it was very American because it was all based on what the Americans call sportswear. So he would do very simple shapes like a man's polo shirt or a pair of pajama trousers, but he'd do them in very luxurious. I think his greatest invention, he took a mid-20th century twin set and made it skinny and dropped it to the floor. And you had a fabulous evening dress and an evening coat and knit. And it was just so modern. That's what made him important.
And I guess that the great skill is, you know, when you do something simple, to actually pair it back to simplicity but still have absolute beauty there.
That was the hardest skill. Yeah, it's the hardest thing to do. And it also makes the clothes very, very difficult to translate into a drama series, because they can, in fact, look quite dull. Someone said to me who watched it with me, oh, there's a lot of beige shirt dresses. And I can see why a modern eye would think that. But at the time, they seemed incredibly revolutionary.
He had made a huge name for himself, Penny, because of one hat, or a hat worn by Jackie Kennedy.
Yeah, he created that pillbox for JFK's inauguration in 1961. And the nugget that I read on multiple Jackie O biographies was that she had a really huge head, and that proved problematic for milliners. And Halston turned out to have the same size of head as Jackie, so he was able to test the hats. And of course, as soon as that hat was seen around the world, he became famous and had his own salon within Bergdorf Goodman.
Yeah. She did stop wearing hats, which is a slight problem, certainly, Peter, for him. And he was very quick to point out how big her hair was, never mind how big her head was. Is it unusual, Peter, for a milliner, as Halston had done then, to expand out of that, I suppose, quite limited market in some ways, and certainly as the 60s progressed, almost a non-existent market, to diversify into, you know, a broader fashion palette?
I can't off the top of my head think of anyone else who did that. But hats were dying. People were stopping wearing hats. I mean, there was, you couldn't leave your house without a hat, and then they just seemed incredibly old-fashioned. But he'd always been involved in sewing. He made dresses for his mother, and he had studied sewing, and he worked in window dressing. So he had a kind of grasp, and he had a very kind of definite sense of taste and style. So he just, and he was madly ambitious. And I think it would have been easier to do back then than it would be today, you know. He was kind of like a precursor to, nowadays the big groups, they hire people who are not necessarily designers. They're called artistic directors. And that's kind of what he was in a funny kind of way, you know.
Yeah, which kind of maybe explains that whole atelier idea, which is getting a group of people together in an attic, in inverted commas, and working out everything as a team.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know how true, you know, how that's the problem with these biopic, biodrama things. I mean, they're not innately dramatic, and there'll always be some, you know, pedantic old fart like me who was kind of around at the tail end of it and say, you know, Liza Minnelli recorded Liza with a Z in 72 and it was supposed to happen in 68 in the programme. But I think, I don't know of any designer who rips clothes off models or who screams at premieres. The people who work in the atelier, if any designer will tell you, are the people they love the most in the work, in the world. These are the people who translate what you do and make it three-dimensional. And a premier, the person who makes your muslins, your toiles, these women are adored by designers. So either they've kind of, you know, exaggerated this in the drama, or he really was a bit of an arsehole. You know.
Well, I suppose you mentioned the Liza Minnelli aspect of things there, and I this maybe gets to the nub of what I think both of you may feel about the series, how it's dramatised in effect. Let's take a clip that features the scene with Liza with a Z, who's played incidentally here by Krista Rodriguez. That's Krista with a Y. Wonder she designed it with a Y after the event. And he's trying to recruit the costumier and illustrator Joe Eula at this point, and so he's just finishing up his conversation with him when Liza comes on to the stage.
You don't want to understand a dress, you want to love it. You want to be Balenciaga, there's already a Balenciaga. What we need is to figure out your signature. What's going to make me see some gorgeous woman out in a supper club wearing a fabulous ensemble and say, that's a Halston.
So, does that mean you're in?
Problem sometimes, and that's my name. Well, for instance, someone might come up to me on the street and say, hello, Lisa, how are you? And I'll say, I'm fine, thank you, but it's Liza. It has a Z in it. Or someone might say, Lisa, what a nice hat you have on. And I'll say, thank you very much, but my name is Liza, and that's my hair.
It's Liza with a Z, not Lisa with an S, because Lisa with an S goes not Z. It's Z instead of S, lie instead of Lee. It's simple as can be. See, Liza.
A little clip there from Halston, the new Netflix series. Krista Rodriguez playing the part of Liza Minnelli there. And you also heard Ewan McGregor as Halston in the midst of that clip as well. Penny, let me come back to you on this aspect. Yeah, Peter touching about the authenticity of certain aspects, even that particular song, which wasn't around at the time they're saying it was around. But this is a series that's based on a book by Stephen Gaines, and that book's called Simply Halston. It covers much of Halston's very decadent private life. How much of that side of his life are we really getting here, I suppose, a discussion of fashion?
I think we're getting much more of the colourful aspect of his life than the couture aspect from my point of view. I think viewers will see the champagne lifestyle. There's champagne, cocaine, cigarettes, Cointreau, limos and outrageous behaviour. Not so much from my point of view. I wanted to see a lot more of the jumpsuits and the silk jersey dresses, but it all looks fabulous and the backdrops are very, very well done. I think that's one of the key points that I really liked about this series, especially his Upper East Side property, which of course is now owned by Tom Ford, the designer. And it's the minimalist setting was fabulous.
I'm wondering to what extent is that your fashion eye really honing in on those things, whereas perhaps will the more general viewer be looking at the drama, the salacious aspects, the very decadent lifestyle that is there. Peter, you said you were around towards the tail end of that period.
Was it as
decadent as we get in this series?
Yeah, you know, I'm probably the only designer that you'll ever meet of my generation who didn't do drugs. And I don't say this to seem like a saint. I just never had any interest in it. And if you don't do them, the people around you know you don't, so they don't tell you. But yeah, there were tons and tons and kilos of cocaine everywhere. They're really were. And I know people, you know, who lost jobs, teeth, lives because of it. And it was like that, you know, and there was a lot. I used to go to Studio 54. We were at Parsons and we could go to Studio because we were young and I suppose we were vaguely cute and they let us in. And yeah, it was kind of mad. Now, we didn't go to the basement where all the serious action happened and all the celebs went. But you'd see them on the dance floor and it was kind of like that. Yeah, it was mad. I just think Ewan McGregor's terrible casting. He's very earthy and kind of solid and looks like he should work on a farm, and he works really hard. He works really hard. He's really game. He shoves his head in a few men's crotches. He's really game about it. But you never, I never believed he was Holston. Holston was very kind of like an he was pretentious idiot, but he had these long hands and he was thinner, and I never really believed Ewan McGregor was Holston.
Oh, you were laughing as Peter was saying that, Penny. Were you laughing in agreement around the Ewan McGregor portrayal?
I thought he was a bit wooden, yes, and I don't think he was necessarily as good looking as Holston was, but he became, I liked him more probably in the very last episode. I didn't like him midway through, and then there was a kind of redemption turning point for me. I thought the finale was beautiful and I actually shed a little tear. I would tend to agree. When he said some of Holston's most famous lines, for example, "You're only as good as the people you dress," it just felt a bit forced. It didn't feel natural.
But what about those around him, Penny? Just staying with you, I think in particular, you might explain who Elsa was, Halston's muse, Elsa. And she's portrayed in the series by Rebecca Dayan. And I think did you like her performance?
Yeah, for me, that was a standout. I thought that Rebecca Dayan played Elsa Peretti, the jewellery designer, who was one of the Halstonettes and Halston's muse particularly well. She was elegant, she was eloquent, she was emotional. She made me want to rush out and buy two bone cuffs and Tiffany. I liked the way that her story also developed. You know, she picked up a little vase and put it on a lanyard, and it became, a necklace that was part of Halston's collection, and then he introduced her to Tiffany. So it was nice to see other incidental stories like that. We also had a little cameo with Ralph Lauren trying to sell his ties. This is a race through American fashion and cultural history. We've got other fashion designers mentioned as well, but for me, Elsa Peretti rocked.
She rocked for you. Let's listen to another clip. Halston again here. He quite flahoolock when it came to the money, and after a lukewarm reception for a new collection, his team, which included Joe Eula, who was one of the people who illustrated his clothes, Elsa Peretti, who we've just mentioned there, Joel Schumacher was in there as well, played by Rory Culkin in this, and the team are in a kind of a crisis mode. And let's face it, Halston was not only colourful in the way he presented himself visually, but also with the language that he used.
Fuck. No, Halston, these are not bad.
They're not good.
Yes, this one is, Santi. Effortless and elegant, Halston is an exciting new voice in women's fashion.
Well, the look they've assembled here is thrown together or contrived. Well, which is it, Bernadine Morris, thrown together or contrived?
This one says you're either young or old, says Halston.
Well, that's neither good nor bad. That's just a quote. He never, ever gets to talk. The collection isn't a success until there are orders. How many orders do we have, Joel?
Not many.
Correct. Zero, which is, yes, not many.
Well, on to the next collection.
What are you talking about? There will be a next collection. This was fucking it. We're $200,000 in debt. We haven't paid the rent of this place. In 2 weeks, they'll turn the lights out.
Well, if we're talking about money, you could maybe spend a little less on orchids.
That is missing the thrust of what I'm saying, and orchids are part of my process. Can't put a budget on inspiration.
Ewan McGregor there as Halston in the series of the same name on Netflix. Peter O'Brien, then, coming to you, Penny mentioning to us that as the series progressed further into it, a certain sympathy grew for him. Was it accurate, first of all? Is that important, or is it about drama here rather than accuracy to fashion?
I listen, these kind of, you know, bio dramas are never really completely accurate. And there's something innately dreary about fashion people talking about frocks. I think no one should ever be allowed to. It's so tedious. It's unbearable. We all should be like Francis Bacon. If I could explain it, I wouldn't paint it, you know. It's fine. I just thought the writing was very soapish. I felt not remotely sorry for any of them. And when, you know, when they try to put this kind of sentimental stuff in Ewan McGregor's mouth at the end, he obviously is a smart man and hated it and underplayed it. So I don't think it works. I thought it was terrible.
Pinning your colours to the mast. Are you in the same camp as that, Penny? Or are you quite as disenchanted as Peter sounds?
Oh, I don't think I'm as that negative. I think this will appeal to so many of us who haven't had a chance to get dressed up or wanting to escape. You know, this will offer some glamour. But for me, there was too much cocaine, not enough clothes.
Too much cocaine, not enough clothes, says Penny McCormick. Terrible, says Peter O'Brien. Thanks to both of you for being with us this evening. And Halston is the programme we were talking about, starring Ewan McGregor. It's available on Netflix now. The Rules of Revelation is the much anticipated new novel from Lisa McInerney, the final act in an award-winning Cork-based trilogy that includes The Glorious Heresies and The Blood Miracles. These raucous comic novels follow the story of Ryan Cusack, from his time as a young drug dealer in 2010 to his current incarnation in The Rules of Revelation as a singer-songwriter with the band Lord Urchin. McInerney, who started out as a writer with a blog called The Arse End of Ireland, is writing about a particularly gritty, if action-packed, side of Cork life, unlikely to show up, I would say, in Falsha Ireland adverts. And delighted to have Lisa with an S, given that you're not Liza with a Z, McInerney, joining us from Galway this evening. Congratulations on the completion of this trilogy. First of all, Lisa, I don't know if you will call it that or not, but maybe you give us a sense of Ryan Cusack, because essentially he's the big driving force really behind the overall arc of the three books together. Where did he start out and where do we find him at in this third part of the story?
Yeah, so I mean, he is, I think, very much the heart of all three books and the character, I suppose, I hope that a reader would be most interested in, because he does do most of the heavy lifting, I think. So in The Glorious Heresies, we meet him, he's just turned 15 and, you know, his mum is dead and he's living with his dad, who has problems with alcohol abuse. And, you know, Ryan has taken an awful lot of that on his shoulders. And he's also decided that a good way for him to make money would be to become a baby drug dealer, essentially. Probably not the best decision anybody's ever made, but can we blame him? He's 15, he's an idiot. Mm. So it continues on in The Blood Miracles. We meet him again, he's 21, 20 going on 21 there. And the kind of all these bad decisions he's made are really kind of culminating in some sort of, I think, mad thriller-like dash where his life is literally on the line. And then we meet him here again now in The Rules of Revelation in the last book, and he's just turned 24, and he considers himself 24 to be quite old and wise at this stage, like we all were when we were 24. And he's decided now what he wants to do is he's always had this kind of musical talent, and what he wants to do now eventually is to actually put it into practice. But will Ireland forgive him? Will Cork forgive him for all the kind of carry-on from when he was younger? So that's the question we're going to answer.
Yeah, that's the one that will be answered for us in the third book for sure. His difficult start in life, you know, as you say, his mum is dead by the time he's a teenager and he's living with his father. Very difficult situation. Lots of younger siblings, you know, a family that have plenty of challenges, and with the father addicted to alcohol, rather feckless in the way he treats most of his life. Ryan, to what extent were you looking at this idea of how Ryan can stay being Ryan Cusack from Cork and yet try to get beyond the difficult start that he had?
Yeah, I mean, that's the interesting thing for a character. When you get a character like Ryan, because I've been with him now for so long and he's kind of led me into some strange places, you can give him all sorts of advantages. You can give him talent, you can give him opportunity. But then as the writer, you're almost following to see what he will make of these, you know, will he take this path or this path and see what happens. So, I mean, that's been the fun thing with him, really, to see now at the end of it how he's going to do, what he's going to manage, what he's going to do with himself.
He's also been, now he hasn't been living in Ireland for all that time, but the Ireland of 2010 and the Ireland of 2019 are rather different places, we would have to say.
Oh, absolutely. Good Lord. I mean, when I was writing The Glorious Heresies, so The Glorious Heresies came out in 2015, but it starts in the year 2010. And you're talking about just post-crash Ireland there. And it felt to me when I was writing it, like, this is an Ireland that's quite unforgiving. This is an Ireland that's quite kind of lost patience, almost lost its way in terms of how it looks after its own. You know, it felt very cold and very judgmental to me when I was writing. And then you think of the Ireland of 2019, you've just come past these two big referendums that kind of changed everything in Ireland to give people a sense of ownership about this country that I think we had been missing in the years prior, in the few years prior. We suddenly felt like we had power and optimism, and it's a completely different Ireland I was writing about, and that in itself was interesting. You know, you take this character who has been judged by the people around him for so long, you bring him into this new Ireland and you say, well, let's see now how you get on. You know, is Ireland even going to have a place for you now, because you are kind of like a representative of its grittier or more unpleasant side, and Ireland now is like, oh no, we're moving forward, you know?
The other interesting thing that I think it allows you to do, I was struck by the character of Mel, who kind of a peripheral character really in the first book. But when it comes into the Rules of Revelation, they are a much more important character. And my use of they there is important.
Yeah, so Mel started out as, in The Glorious Heresies, we would have seen Mel as Linda, who was the daughter of Tara Duan, who was, I think, the big villain of The Glorious Heresies, and possibly still the big villain of the three books. And Mel has gone away to Scotland to live with her dad, and has become, or has tried to figure out who they actually are, and has decided, well, maybe I'm not a girl, actually, but am I? I don't think I'm a boy either. I'm not really sure what I am. And that was an interesting thing for me to capture. I think we've been having these very interesting conversations around gender in Ireland very recently. Certainly, like, I have a teenager, I have a 19-year-old who started off as a girl and is now very much a boy. So we've been having all of these amazing kind of conversations about gender, and where we're, you know, what the limits are, and what, how we can push them, and how we can kind of be more ourselves and feel more authentically ourselves. What does all of this mean? No answers, of course. Yeah. I mean, we're just trying to figure it out. So I was writing Mel. That was kind of what I wanted to capture. I think another kind of symptom, I suppose, of this new optimism I felt in Ireland, this new kind of thing of moving past binaries, moving past kind of class structures, moving past limitations, all of this kind of stuff.
The other thing that you do, and this is across the three novels, Lisa, and it's one of the absolutely gorgeous things about it, is the authenticity of the patois and the Cork accent. Mm. And you're not from Cork, but you're a bit of a blow in there for a while. And clearly,
don't attack me.
I mean, I'm not even a blow in Cork. But, you know, clearly your ears were wide open when you were at college in Cork, because you have, to my ear at any rate, you have it down pat.
Oh, I'm glad you said that. Like, but I think sometimes you have to have the little bit of the outsider's perspective to really hear the kind of idiosyncrasies and the kind of these beautiful little patterns, no matter where you are, no matter where you've moved to. And Cork, for me, as people probably remember at this stage, because I bang on so much about it, I moved down there at 17. I had just turned 17. Like, I turned 17 in August, and I started UCC in October. So I was very, very young. And move down there, and kind of, that's a dangerous age to be going anywhere, isn't it? Like, to be kind of in this new city and kind of on your own and kind of figuring out who you are and stuff. And that's one of the things I could hear. I used to walk around Cork City and I would hear the patterns and the rhythm of the language and the new slang and all of this kind of stuff. So I lived then in Cork for years afterwards. Like, my son went to primary school in Cork, and I used to work in construction out there. So I used to kind of have all of these, like, colleagues who are proper Corkmen who'd, you know, delight in being able to kind of tell me all of these amazing pieces of slang and stuff like that. I mean, I loved it. So, I mean, it means a lot to be able to get it right. Yeah. So if you say I've gotten it right, that's a good thing.
Well, a Monaghan man telling you you've got the Cork patois man right now is a whole different ballgame.
I'll take it.
Yeah, okay. I'll grant it without any imprimatur from Cork to do so. The other interesting, or one of the many interesting things about the story too, right across the three, it's a multi-generational story, Lisa. you know, we have a kind of, we've really got three generations in here. If my maths is kind of right, if I'm thinking of Maureen Phelan, who's I suppose she's heading towards 70 now, really, isn't it? And her son Jimmy P, who's the kind of the linchpin drug dealer aspect of the whole thing. He'd be in his probably 30s or 40s in the
action. He's hitting 50.
Oh, is he hitting 50 at this?
He's hitting 50
at this. Yeah, Maureen was young. Yeah, it's okay.
She was.
He's hitting 50 at this point. How are that generation, for you, in terms of how you're portraying them across the three novels, how are they coping with the changes of the decade that has just finished, 2010 through to 2020?
Do you know, I find it very interesting, and I can't really speak for, obviously, a big sweeping kind of like, here's what the generations above mine think. But like, I find it very interesting talking to the likes of my Nana now, who would be in her 80s. Like, all of these changes are kind of almost accepted with a shrug. It's kind of like, oh God, this isn't what I saw coming, but I suppose whatever you're happy with, you know. So there seems to be, I think anyway, a multi-generational acceptance of the way Ireland's going.
Yeah, because is the conversation about the Magdalene Laundries, is that intergenerational? There's quite an important conversation and discussion around that whole issue in the book as well, isn't there?
I think it is. I think it's something that obviously older women would have grown up and kind of been formed in those times and very much kind of had to deal with these kind of limits that were put on their lives by the Catholic Church and by the state and stuff. So obviously it means a lot to them. But not just like for my generation too, kind of trying to figure out what that means for us to be moving into a post-Catholic Ireland. I mean, we're still very much formed by what the past was. Do you know? So, I mean, and the changes that we want to make as younger people as well are obviously informed by the pain that previous generations went through. So, you know, I mean, I think it is an issue that affects everybody. I think it's an issue that interests everybody and people want to get right, you know?
ITV Studios working on a TV adaptation. You're in the area of screenwriting here as well. Adapting your own work, how difficult has it been? And what stage are we at? You know, obviously COVID hit a lot of things and kind of pushed them back.
Oh, God, yeah. I can't even say what stage we're at the moment because COVID really kind of did a number on things, I think, in terms of reimagining budgets and reimagining this. And suddenly the person that was, you know, hired for this particular thing is no longer available because their schedule got pushed out in another direction, and oh, it's just all been a bit of a mess. But in terms of the adaptation for me, I've been having great crack with it. I mean, like, it's a story that obviously I came up with, so I love very much, and the opportunity to go in and look at it from a different angle and kind of try and tell it again and in a completely different medium, which has different kind of necessities. You have to kind of learn to tell it all over again and getting time to spend with the characters again.
I was thinking you wouldn't want to let go of them that quickly because they've been with you for decades now. So in terms of prose, will there be a new Cork, a new patois, or have you any idea what'll happen there?
In terms of the next book, is it? I don't know. I'm thinking I might try and stretch myself and kind of move away from Cork and see what happens. I don't know. Here's the thing. Like, I have a good idea in terms of the structure of a plot, but until I start writing down characters and seeing how these people talk, that's kind of I'll figure out the patois, as you say, that is correct for them. So we don't know. Joe, I might write the great Monaghan novel.
We'll get a Cork man to tell you whether the accent's right or not. Listen, lovely to speak with you, Lisa, and congrats, as I say, on the novel. That's Lisa McInerney, The Rules of Revelation, latest in her trilogy. The last in the trilogy is published by John Murray, and Lisa is taking part in the Crosstown Drift at Cork Midsummer Festival on 19th of June. You can find out full details on corkmidsummer.com. And so to our album reviews on this Friday evening. St. Vincent is the stage name of American musician, singer, songwriter and producer Annie Erin Clark. She releases her seventh album today. It's called Daddy's Home. Music veteran and icon who seems never to run out of energy, Paul Weller released his 15th album On Sunset just under a year ago. In between that and his 16th album, which we're talking about this evening, he found time to produce Declan O'Rourke's latest album. The 16th album is called Fat Pop, Volume 1, which suggests there's more to come. And finally, Georgia Smith, 23-year-old singer-songwriter from Walsall in England. Huge response and widespread acclaim for her debut back in 2018. Picked up 2 Brit Awards in the meantime. Today, her follow-up to that debut arrives and it is called Be Right Back. Nadine O'Regan, Brian Boyd have been listening. Let's start with St. Vincent, opening track from her current album, Daddy's Home. The track is called Pay Your Way in Pain.
Stand up, head down, hands up, and
Pay Your Way in Pain, opening track on St. Vincent's new album, Daddy's Home. And as I said, it's Brian Boyd and Nadine O'Regan who are with us on this Friday evening. Nadine, Daddy's Home is the title of the album. There's a feeling here, perhaps, is there, that we're getting closer to, I suppose, the personal side of St. Vincent's life, in that there's a kind of autobiographical basis in the songs and on the album?
Yeah, I think that'd be fair to say. I mean, over the course of her 7 albums, she's shown us so many different personae, and she's really, I think, experimented with the visuals and the form of her music. She's moved from synths, of course, she's brilliant on guitar as well, but she's kind of run through a lot of different genres. And sometimes there's a feeling that she's a bit of a chameleon, that she's an actor, if you like, and she doesn't like to show us her emotional core. I think she got a little bit closer in 2017's Mass Seduction, where she's that track New York was beautiful, but in this particular album, she's chosen to showcase a very personal side, not maybe entirely something she wanted to show, but in 2016, the tabloids broke the news that back in 2010, her father had been sentenced to 12 years in prison for his part in a $43 million stock manipulation scheme, which, you know, was really quite extraordinary. So he went to jail, she went to the waiting room to go and see him and found herself signing autographs. The tabloids exposed it partly because of her relationship with Cara Delevingne, the model, because she suddenly became of interest to the tabloids. And then for this album, she has decided to take control of the narrative. So the album is called Daddy's Home, and it's a hugely 1970s drenched record, loads of inspiration from that particular era. But then lyrically, it's taking from her experiences of the past few years, and sometimes wry, sometimes quite emotional and personal, and often communicating that as much through tone as through her lyrics.
How did you respond to her representation of this story and her take on her father's incarceration, Brian?
I went back to have a look at the trial of her father. Her father is Richard Clark. He's an Irish-American. He ruined the lives of 17,000 working American families, swindling them out of $43 million. The judge also highlighted the case that Richard Clark exploited the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina, which was a catastrophic natural disaster in the US. St. Vincent has... she's referred to her father in the past as an honest thief. And in Rolling Stone magazine, she referred to a 12-month custodial prison sentence her father got for stealing $43 million from 17,000 working American families as blithely as some white-collar nonsense. Oh. On this album, remarkably, she sings about her father, "We're all born innocent, but some good saints get screwed." It's immoral what she's doing here. It's an interesting choice of phrase, good saint, to describe a man who ruined so many lives and who exploited Hurricane Katrina. It's not the job of the musician, Sean, to comfort the rich and privileged. There was a chance for St. Vincent on this to talk about the American prison industrial complex.
She doesn't do
that. Or American criminal justice system. She doesn't.
12-year stretch, in fact, that he got, and I think it was reduced to 10 subsequently. What about the music side of things then? Coming back to you, Nadine, you mentioned the 1970s, but the first thing I wrote down when that opening track played was Prince. Immediately, it came into my head.
I thought of Prince too. Yeah, absolutely. And Stevie Wonder. And, you know, one of the things about Annie Clark is she's always been such a remarkable, just sheer musician, guitarist. You know, she's one of those extraordinary talents, began learning guitar, I believe, at the age of 5, and kicked off her career working with artists. Well, she was in Polyphonic Spree, worked with Sufjan Stevens. David Byrne, of course, is another collaborator. And sonically, this album is fascinating. There's so many moments where, you know, there could be a little groove that she falls into, and it's just so entrancing and engaging. I understand where Brian is coming from on the lyrical side of things, but I'm not sure it's her job to either comfort or excoriate. You know, I think that as an artist, she is representing what it might feel like to be the daughter. And I didn't get a sense through the record that she was excusing her father, more that she was occupying a place in the firmament where that has happened in her life and representing it in a way that is potentially a little bit more truthful than has potentially been the case on previous albums. I think it's a big thing to do to ask someone to turn around and damn their parent, and she doesn't choose to do that, but neither, I think, does she go in quite the other direction.
Well, what about the voice that she uses to sing with here, Brian? There's no doubting the, well, to me anyway, the versatility of the instrument.
Just before that, Sean, she does actually refer to her father as a good saint on this album, and that for me is disgraceful. Absolutely disgraceful. And I don't think people should be given a cover. Also, the fact that she's themed the album around her father, and instead of looking at the prison industrial complex or the US criminal justice system, she's writing about how she had to write autographs for her fans in the waiting room to see her father. She's writing about how her clothes were so tight the prison warders said that she had to go and change them in case she titillated the prison population. So I don't think we should be given a cover for this. There are disgraceful aspects to this album, and I think there's a bourgeois cultural commentariat who give her cover because she's seen as being edgy and cool, but we have to realise this is a rich white girl giving succour to her stockbroker father, who has committed appalling crimes and ruined the lives of 17,000 working families. On her voice, on the whole album, I found it dreadfully derivative. I thought that the opening track, Pay Your Way in Pain, you said it reminds you of Prince. It reminded me very much of David Bowie's Fame song from the Young American album. And again, she has said in interviews that she wanted to recreate the sound of the vinyl records her father played her when she was young, which include David Bowie and Pink Floyd. So we get a song like Live Your Dreams, and then I'm thinking, this is a very good song. However, it owes an awful lot to Pink Floyd's Us and Them. Even the guitar solo mimics David Gilmour's guitar solo. There's a song she presents as an original song, My Baby Wants a Baby. It's a cover version of Sheena Easton's 9 to 5, better known as My Baby Takes a Morning Train. In fact, she had to credit the original songwriter of the Sheena Easton song in the credits. So when she's saying the music is all the this is all the music I've listened to most of my life, that's fine as a starting point, but not just to rethread it and offer something, offer nothing different. The only new song here I really is Candy Darling, which is brilliant. And I am a huge fan of St. Vincent. I do believe, I subscribe to the theory that she is as interesting to this generation as David Bowie and Kate Bush were to other generations. I just feel very disappointed in her treatment of her father and giving a rich white man.
Okay, let's have a listen to a second track here, Down and Out, Downtown.
It's a long way back downtown.
Down and Out, Downtown from St. Vincent, from her new album, Daddy's Home. I think there'll be a big difference of opinion here in stars. Let's go to you first, Brian.
I'm a huge fan, very disappointed, 2.5 stars.
And what are you saying, Nadine?
I think it's a beautiful work, and I'm reviewing the work, so 4 stars.
4 stars from you. Right, nice to have a difference of opinion as well, isn't it? Next up, album number 16 from the legend that is Paul Weller, following hot on the heels of last year's On Sunset. Brian, you were one of those who enthusiastically received album number 15 last year. So, Fat Pop, Volume 1, it has to be said. A welcome arrival for you?
Very much so, yeah. And this is like two albums in the space of 12 months. And he's also produced some albums, as you were saying in the intro. Mm. And he was asked why, you know, why are you releasing so much? Normally he'd release once every 3 or 4 years. And he just charmingly replied to the interviewer, there's nothing else to do, is there? And I think we can all subscribe to that. The great thing about this album, Sean, is that normally, I mean, we've reviewed here a number of lockdown albums, and they're very sort of moody and very downbeat, very minor keys, very introspective, and very much weighed down by the gloom of the world. Paul Weller's gone the opposite way. He's bringing us on a magical mystery tour here. It's fantastic stuff. You're going from sci-fi, sonic opera into blues, into indie guitar rock. There's a jazz flute song. If somebody had mentioned to me there's a jazz flute song, I would normally reach for my revolver. Here it's one of the best songs on the album.
Let's listen to the title track, Fat Pop.
Who's never ever let you down?
Fat Pop, the title track from Paul Weller's new album, Fat Pop Volume 1, the title of which even makes me smile. Nadine, Brian touching there on the diversity of style across the album. He's quite the man, Paul Weller. Or do you agree?
I do. I mean, there's so much joy in the execution of this record and so much true love for music that, you know, even on the initial listens to it, I found myself kind of wanting to add in like harmonies in the backdrop, or, you know, it has a great optimism to it that is truly beautiful as we're coming out of a very, very tough time. And, you know, I think it probably is intentional. His own, you know, obviously touring plans were cancelled, and he is very much in a purple patch. I mean, it's his fifth album since 2015, which is really just incredible. Yeah. And I love the contributors he has here. He's got his daughter Leah with him on Shades of Blue, and many other, like Liam Metcalf is there for a really beautiful track as well, and Andy Fairweather Lowe on Testify, and some lovely lyrics as well. I mean, ultimately, it has the feel of, yes, you know, we know Weller, we know exactly what he's capable of, but he still sounds pretty fresh.
Yeah, and does he manage across the 12 songs, despite the diversity of styles? Is there a unity there, Brian?
There is, because he also, I mean, it is 12 singles, but the great thing is that he keeps you on your toes in this album. So you'd be listening to a song and suddenly disco beats will appear, or a blues rock riff, or on certain songs just a gospel chorus just emerges stage left and you're going, what?
Where did that come from?
And it is held together, and they're very tight songs. I mean, he has been guilty in the past maybe of noodling away for 7-8 minutes, but I think here they're all below four minutes. So it really is 12 3-minute singles, and they work.
Yeah, they really do. You've both mentioned Testify. You mentioned it there, Nadine, and Paul, you mentioned it in terms, or Brian, you mentioned it in terms of the
jazz flute.
The flute and the Hammond organ in there as well. Let's have a little listen.
Get up and testify.
Get up and testify.
There we go. You know, in lesser hands, I wrote down when this started, are we going into a loungy type of song from Paul Weller? But he manages to hold it together. Did the album work overall for you, Nadine, and what he's saying, stars?
Yeah, it's a confident, lovely record. 3.5 stars.
And what are you saying, Brian?
4 stars for me. I loved it.
4 stars from you. 3.5 and 4. A little bit more accord on that one. Let's move on then to Georgia Smith. Be Right Back. 2018 debut album Lost and Found. Hail is an R&B masterpiece. 2019, she won the Best British Female Artist at the Brit Awards. Nominated for the Grammy Award for Best New Artist. And today we get the follow-up to the debut. The album is called Be Right Back. Let's have a listen to a track called Gone.
Yeah. How can my world be much better off without?
And that's a track called Gone from Georgia Smith's new album Be Right Back. Nadine, she was 21 when the breakthrough happened with the debut album. Spotlight that is on her for this second album is huge, obviously. Just give us a little bit of her background and what she's managed to do in her relatively short life.
Yeah, well, I mean, as you were saying, I mean, she has been Mercury nominated for her debut record, Lost and Found. She's just 23 now. She's worked with the likes of Drake and really is one of those people who is coming up in the landscape of that certain type of pop female vocalist where you can think of her in the same breath as Lorde or Celeste or Arlo Parks. Having said that, though, I have to be honest, like the name of the 8-track project is called Be Right Back. And to me, you could have also called it Odds and Ends. I mean, there's a feeling that this isn't the album proper. The album proper is yet to come. And this is being released. And I think she's more or less said this. This is being released just to give her fans something to grab onto before she releases the big record. And as such, I did feel there was a lack of dimension and complexity to this particular project in ways I wish that she'd waited, because I didn't, while I think that her vocal quality is absolutely stunning and she's got an amazing way with phrasing, she's really dexterous as a vocalist and she gets a lot of emotion in there. At the same time, I found overall as a listening experience, it was a bit more mundane than I was expecting.
Yeah, I was kind of surprised when I got to the end of the 8th track. I went, oh, right, that's it all. How manufactured a sound are we getting here, Brian, or how natural a sound are we getting?
She's very she's renowned for the fact that she refused to sign to a major label, Sean. She wanted to retain her independence, and she was, I mean, so often we find with the R&B sound, which is the dominant mode of expression now, we find they're called music industry plants. They're sort of artists who are dreamed up by a label executive, and they focus on a target market. And you just feel that with some artists, but here with Georgia, you're getting the sense that this is a person who won't take any advice from anybody, and she's very much intent on ploughing her own furrow. Kendrick Lamar and Stormzy have both got on the phone when they heard her voice, both got on the phone and said, "Please work with me." She's a sort of, if she were in a major label, you could see her being turned into a Sade type figure, you know, nice, easy listening. But what I liked on this is that she's doing trip hop, she's doing drum and bass, there's a great collaboration with a young South London rapper, and she's really flexing her muscles artistically. Yeah. I don't think it is a holding album as such. I think this is very much a statement.
You mentioned the track that features Shebo. Let's have a quick listen, because I want to get in a little bit of him in there.
Run it now. You want to head at the flight leaves at noon. She want to buy Chanel, they just dropped them 2 bags. They want another, now you're asking for too much. Order what you like. Don't have to pay about the parties at midnight. She wants to answer that for so bad to feel nice. But she gon' handle that, it comes with a small price. Yeah, I give, you take. Been keeping track like I'm a train. Even with drip, I'm feeling drained. It's getting long hair like braids. 2 sides, either really rude or too nice. So before it goes left, you better move right.
I just wanted to hear a little bit of him there. That Shebo and the Georgia Smith track, Bus Town. Finally, Nadine, did the album work overall? You're saying a holding album. What would you say in terms of stars as a final judgment?
Yeah, I think she has world-class vocal abilities, but the songwriting for me just wasn't there on this, so I'm going to go 2.5.
2.5. What are you saying, Brian?
I didn't like the soft, easy listening. There's 3 songs there, but the other 5 songs I thought were excellent, so 3.5 for me.
3.5 from Brian Boyd and Nadine O'Regan. And Brian Boyd speaking to us this evening about Georgia Smith, Be Right Back, Paul Weller's Fat Pop, Volume 1, and St. Vincent's Daddy's Home. That is our lot for this evening. Liam Murphy and Paula Shields Research. Janice Furphy was the broadcast coordinator. Sheila Nivuel was on sound this evening, and tonight's programme was produced by Olin McGowan. Back with you Monday, 7 o'clock here on RTÉ Radio 1.